and proceeded. The road was bad, as usual, with much deadfall. That night, the party finished the horse Clark had provided. It wasn't much. But sitting around the campfire, cold, hungry, exhausted, and miserable, Lewis summoned the energy to make significant additions to scientific knowledge, if he could get his journals back to civilization. He described the varied thrush, Steller's jay, the gray jay, the black woodpecker, known today as Lewis's woodpecker, the blue grouse, the spruce grouse, and the Oregon ruffed grouse, as well as the mountain huckleberry, the Sitka alder, and the western red cedar, called Arbor Vitae by Lewis. All but the thrush were unknown to science. On September 21st, Lewis didn't get started until 11 o'clock a.m. because he had to wait for the horses to be collected and his own pack horse to be brought in. He traveled down the heavily timbered bottom of a creek where the deadfall was so bad that it was almost impracticable to proceed. At 5 miles, he came to Clark's campsite on what Clark had named Hungry Creek, as at that place we had nothing to eat. After 6 more miles, Lewis came to a small open bottom where there was tolerable food for our horses and camped. "I directed the horses to be hubbled to prevent delay in the morning," he wrote. He was determined to make a forced march tomorrow in order to reach, if possible, the open country. The hunters killed a few grouse. Lewis killed a prairie wolf, coyote, which, with the leftover horse meat and some crayfish, provided one more hearty meal, not knowing where the next was to be found. "I find myself growing weak for the want of food, and most of the men complain of a similar deficiency and have fallen off very much." In the morning, to Lewis's chagrin, one of the men had neglected to comply with the order to hobble his horse. He pled ignorance of the order. Not until 11:30 a.m. did the party get started. It had proceeded some 2.5 miles when it met Private Reuben Field, a member of Clark's party, whom Clark had sent to meet Lewis with some dried fish and roots obtained from the Nez Perce. Field said that there was an Indian village some 7 miles farther west that Clark had made a friendly contact with the Nez Perce and had been able to procure food from them. This was great news, as welcome as the fish and roots, which were sufficient to satisfy completely all our appetites. After eating, the party proceeded to a village of 18 lodges, which it reached at 5 o'clock p.m. The expedition had made 160 miles since it left Traveler's Rest 11 days ago. It was one of the great forced marches in American history. Lewis tried to describe his emotions. "The pleasure I now felt in having triumphed over the Rocky Mountains and descending once more to a level and fertile country where there was every rational hope of finding a comfortable subsistence for myself and party can be more readily conceived than expressed, nor was the flattering prospect of the final success of the expedition less pleasing. Outstanding leadership made possible the triumph over the Rocky Mountains. Lewis and Clark had welded the core of discovery into a tough, superbly disciplined family. They had built an unquestioning trust in themselves and knew the strengths and skills of each of their men intimately. They had taken a calculated risk in trusting old Toby, but their judgment that he knew what he was talking about, even though the talking was in sign language, proved to be justified. In extremely trying conditions, we suffered everything cold, hunger, and fatigue could impart, Lewis later wrote, as well as the keenest anxiety excited for the fate of our expedition in which our whole souls were embarked. The captains managed to keep morale from collapsing. The men never sulked, lashed out, demanded to retreat, or insisted on some alternative route. When the captains decided to take the great risk of separating, with Clark going on ahead, no man protested. Private Field told Lewis that Clark was at a second village, gathering information from the Nez Perce. At dark, Clark returned and joined Lewis. "I found Captain Lewis and the party encamped," he wrote, "much fatigued and hungry, much rejoiced to find something to eat of which they appeared to partake plentifully." Clark's experience was that too many roots had made his hunters violently ill, "so I cautioned them of the consequences of eating too much, etc." Clark was accompanied by Twisted Hair, a Nez Perce chief in his mid-60s whom Clark described as a cheerful man with apparent sincerity. Clark was the first white man most of the Nez Perce had ever seen. He informed Lewis that there were two villages in the area, called by the captains the Quamash Flats, or the Camas Flats, today's Weipe Prairie near Weipe, Idaho, where the Indian women gathered great quantities of camas roots which they made into a kind of bread or cake. He said that at his request, Twisted Hair had drawn him a map on a white elk skin of the country to the west. Twisted Hair showed the creek they were on emptying into the Clearwater River, which was soon joined by a river coming in from the northeast, the North Fork of the Clearwater, and then flowing west to join with the Columbia. It was a 5-sleep journey to the Columbia, then another 5 sleeps to the falls of the Columbia. At the falls, Clark said, Twisted Hair places establishments of white people, etc., and informs that great numbers of Indians reside on all those forks, as well as the main river. If Twisted Hair was right, the expedition was within 10 days of the falls and a couple of weeks from the ocean. But the captains had learned that either Indian estimates of distances were too optimistic, or the Indians traveled a lot faster than the white men. And that business about white people living at the falls sounded suspicious. Anyway, the expedition wasn't going anywhere until it found trees big enough to make canoes. Over the next couple of days, the captains handed out medals to Twisted Hair and 3 lesser chiefs, along with shirts, knives, handkerchiefs, and tobacco. These trifles, except for the knives, did not satisfy. At the end of the 2nd day, the Nez Perce indicated they were no longer going to feed the expedition for free. The captains traded from their diminishing supply of goods for more roots, berries, and dried fish. Clark's warning about overeating was easier given than followed. Lewis and his men gorged themselves and got sick, Lewis especially so. Most of the party were violently ill for a week, their dysentery producing acute diarrhea and vomiting. All complain of a lax and heaviness at the stomach, Clark wrote, so I gave Rush's pills. That was probably the worst thing he could have done. In any case, the following day, September 24th, Lewis was so sick he was scarcely able to ride on a gentle horse, several men so unwell that they were compelled to lie on the side of the road for some time. Clark was nothing if not persistent. He handed out more of Rush's pills. The sickness was presumably the result of the change of diet from all meat to all roots and dried fish. Bacteria on the salmon may have contributed. On the 25th, Lewis was still suffering from severe gastrointestinal distress. Clark tried giving him some salts and tartar emetic, another laxative, which hurt more than helped. The next day, Clark tried salts, pills, jalap, another purgative, tartar emetic, etc., again with unhappy results. By the 27th, most of the men were still sick, including Lewis. On the 28th, Clark opened his journal entry, our men nearly all complaining of their bowels, a heaviness at the stomach, and lax. Not until the 30th could Clark report, the men recruiting a little. But they were still on a fish and roots diet, which the men complain of as working them as much as a dose of salts. In short, for over a week, the expedition resembled a hospital ward for the critically ill more than it did a platoon of fighting men. Herein lies one of the great stories of American history, even though it is a tale of what didn't happen rather than what did. It would have been the work of a few moments only for the Nez Perce to kill the white men and take for themselves all the expedition's goods. Had the Indians done so, they would have come into possession of by far the biggest arsenal not just west of the Rocky Mountains, but west of the Mississippi River, along with priceless kettles, axes, hatchets, beads, and other trade items in quantities greater than any of them would ever see in their lifetimes. Like the Shoshones, the Nez Perce had had no contact with whites, other than some cheap trade goods that had reached them from Columbia River tribes. They had only 1 or 2 inferior rifles. They were constantly harassed by their neighbors who did have guns, especially by the Blackfeet, when the Nez Perce made their annual trip over the mountains to the buffalo country. The Nez Perce were hardly oblivious to their once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. According to their oral history tradition, when they first met Clark and his 6 hunters, who had also gorged themselves on roots and fish and gotten dysentery, they considered killing them for their weapons. They were dissuaded by a woman named Watkuwius, meaning return from a far country. She had been captured by Blackfeet some 6 or 7 years earlier, taken into Canada, and sold to a white trader. She lived with him, among other traders, for several years before somehow finding her way home. The traders had treated her much better than the Blackfeet had done, so when Clark arrived, she told the warriors, "These are the people who helped me. Do them no hurt." First Sacajawea, now Watkuwius. The expedition owed more to Indian women than either captain ever acknowledged, and the United States owed more to the Nez Perce for their restraint than it ever acknowledged. When, in 1877, the Army, carrying out government policy, drove Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce from their Idaho home, there were in the band old men and women who had as children been in Twisted Hair's village. During the week Lewis was on his back, Clark moved camp to the junction of the North Fork of the Clearwater with the main stream, where there were ponderosa pines of sufficient size to make canoes. With only a few healthy men and inadequate axes, Clark resorted to the Indian method of canoe making. Instead of hewing out the trunks, he put them over a slow-burning fire trench and burned them out. Apparently, Twisted Hair showed him how to do it. It took 10 days to complete 4 large and 1 small canoe. Twisted Hair also promised to look after the expedition's herd of 38 horses until the Americans came back in the spring on their return journey. Clark had the horses branded with Lewis's branding iron, and to accompany the party to serve as an intermediary with Indians downstream. The captains had assumed that when they got out of the mountains, they would be in a country with an ample supply of deer and elk. They were wrong. The hunters, though still on their feet, were unsuccessful. Fish and roots purchased from the Nez Perce remained the diet. On October 4th, Lewis was still sick. The next day, Clark reported, "Captain Lewis and myself ate a supper of roots boiled, which filled us so full of wind that we were scarcely able to breathe. All night felt the effects of it." On October 6th, the canoes were finished. Clark made a cache for the saddles and a canister of powder. "I am very sick all night," he recorded. "Pain in stomach and the bowels." The next day, he opened his journal entry. "I continue very unwell, but obliged to attend everything." Evidently, Lewis was still so sick he couldn't even supervise the men's work. Lewis later wrote, "For my own part, I suffered a severe indisposition for 10 or 12 days, sick, feeble, and emaciated." Clark had the canoes put into the water and loaded. At 3 o'clock p.m., the party set out. The river was swift with many bad rapids. Nevertheless, they made 20 miles. The expedition was once again waterborne, going downstream for the first time since Lewis had turned the keelboat from the Ohio into the Mississippi River 2 years earlier. Ahead lay the Pacific. Chapter 24. Down the Columbia. October 8th to December 7th, 1805. As the expedition sped down the Clearwater toward its junction with the Snake, Lewis recuperated from his 2-week bout with dysentery. On October 9th, Clark recorded, "Captain Lewis recovering fast." Soon he was as active as always. On October 13th, the party came to a very bad place, a long, bad rapid in which the water is confined in a channel of about 20 yards between rugged rocks for the distance of a mile. It cried out for portaging, but the captains and the men wanted to get on. They were on the last leg and finally had gravity working for them. So Clark recorded, "Captain Lewis with 2 canoes set out and passed down the rapid. The others soon followed, and we passed over this bad rapid safe." The dugout canoes were cumbersome. They overturned or grounded on rocks. They swamped. They sprung leaks. Supplies were damaged, trade goods lost. Men's lives were endangered. The captains ran the rapids anyway, as many as 15 in a day. Old Toby was so frightened by the running of the rapids that he took off that night, without waiting for his pay. He was last seen running eastward along the riverbank. The captains asked Twisted Hair to send a horseman after Old Toby to ask him to come back to be paid, but Twisted Hair advised against such a course. The Nez Perce, he pointed out, would only take it from him as he passed their camps. Old Toby did pick up two of the expedition's horses to ride back over the Lolo Trail and then to Kami Await's village on the Lemhi. On October 10th, the expedition reached the Snake River, coming in from the left, south. The party camped that night near the site of present Lewiston, Idaho. The men bought dogs and dried fish from local Indians. "All the party have greatly the advantage of me," Clark reported, "inasmuch as they all relish the flesh of the dogs." On the 14th, the unhappy Clark shot some ducks and was able to record, "For the first time for 3 weeks past, I had a good dinner of blue-winged teal." The expedition swept on toward the junction of the Snake and the Columbia, passing through the canyon-lined Snake on into present Washington State, where the great Columbian Plain offered a barren landscape in stark contrast to the wooded mountains the party was leaving behind. Along the way, the expedition passed innumerable Indian villages. The natives were members of the extended Nez Perce Nation, by far the largest and most powerful of the tribes of the Pacific Northwest. They had more horses than any tribe on the continent and were the only North American Indians to practice selective breeding. They scorned eating horse flesh. Their diet was primarily deer and elk, supplemented by large quantities of fish. The Columbia and Snake River system, on which they lived, produced more salmon than any other river in the world. Their catches were incredible. One man could kill 100 salmon on a good day, a full ton or more of fish. The Indians were hospitable, partly because Twisted Hair and another Nez Perce chief named Tito Harsky went ahead of the party to reassure their relatives that the white men were friendly, partly because, in Clark's words, "The wife of Charbonneau, our interpreter, we find reconciles all the Indians as to our friendly intentions. A woman with a party of men is a token of peace." Lewis was torn between his desire to keep moving and the need to bring the Nez Perce into the American orbit. He was not in American territory. Neither the United States nor Great Britain had established sovereignty over the Pacific Northwest. Both countries wanted it and had some sort of claim, as did the Russians and the Spanish. But Lewis and Clark were the first white men to enter present Idaho, Washington, and Oregon by land. Although they never planted a flag to make a formal claim on the territory for the United States, they acted as if it were already theirs. Lewis took a vocabulary of the different bands as they were encountered. He found variations in words, but correctly concluded that they had a common origin. Twisted Hair could understand them. The Yakimaws, Wanapoms, Walla Wallas, and others all belonged to the same Shahaptian language family. They practiced a similar economy. They were all rich in dogs as well as horses. Not wanting to waste time sending out hunters, the captains continued to purchase dogs to have some meat to supplement their fish and roots. To bring the various branches of the Nez Perce into active participation in the American trading system, Lewis practiced his usual Indian diplomacy. Around the campfires on the banks of the rivers, he gave his speech expressing his joy in seeing those of our children around us, and handed out medals with Jefferson's likeness on them. He urged the Indians to make peace with their neighbors and promised them trade goods, and he began to form in his mind a grand scheme involving the Nez Perce that would cut the British out of the fur trade with the Orient. But long-term plans for an American takeover could be arranged in the spring, when the expedition could take its time going back upstream, since there was no point arriving on the western base of the Bitterroots before the snow had melted sufficiently to make a crossing practicable. That figured to be June at best, mid-July at worst. So when Chief Yelept of the Walla Walla Band asked Lewis to stay longer so that his people might come to see the white men, the captain excused himself. He wanted to keep moving. He promised instead that the party would spend a few days with Yelep's people in the spring. No matter how badly Lewis and Clark wanted good relations with the natives, sometimes they put daily needs first. "We have made it a point at all times not to take anything belonging to the Indians, even their wood," Clark noted on October 14th, "but since there was no timber on the island where the party camped that night, we are compelled to violate that rule and take a part of the split timber we find here. The next night, we were obliged for the first time to take the property of the Indians without the consent or approbation of the owner. The night was cold and we made use of a part of those boards and split logs for firewood." Stealing from the natives was as easy as it was tempting. The captains hated having it done to them, which was beginning to happen with increasing frequency as they made their way west. The articles taken were small, but because the trade goods were the captain's capital and diminishing fast, their anger was large. Still, their spirits were soaring. At night, around the fire, Private Crusade brought out his violin, to the delight of the men, who danced to the music, and to the Indian guests, who watched and then did their own dancing. On October 15th, Lewis took a walk on the plains about the river and saw in the distance a mountain range that could only be the Cascades. The next day, the party reached the junction with the Columbia, the first white men to be on the river east of the Cascades. They camped for 2 days. Clark investigated the Columbia for about 10 miles upstream. The men were astonished at the numbers of salmon in the river, mostly dying after the spawn and therefore inedible. The water was so clear that no matter how deep the river, the bottom was plainly visible. By now, signs that the Pacific could not be far distant were everywhere. The nearness of the trading emporium at the mouth of the Columbia was apparent from items possessed by the natives, including scarlet and blue cloth blankets and a sailor's jacket. On October 19th, Clark climbed a cliff and saw a snow-covered mountain, which he deduced must be one of the mountains laid down by Vancouver as seen from the mouth of the Columbia River. He thought it was Mount St. Helens. Actually, it was Mount Adams. But his essential point was right. Lewis's and Clark's sightings of the Cascades made the first connection, the first transcontinental linking, of what would become the United States. Lewis had long realized that the Columbia